was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Mercy Hospital, April 6th, 1944.
And what were your parents' names?
My father's name was John B. McKeever, and my mother was Rita M. McKeever.
What did they do for a living?
They're deceased, but my father worked for Union Switch and Signal, and he was an analyst, and my mother was a school teacher.
What was this company again? Union Switch?
And Signal.
And Signal. What was this? What was this business, this company?
It was in the railroad signal business.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he was an analyst there in production management.
What kind of school, what level of school and subjects did your mother teach?
My mother was an English teacher in middle school now, sixth grade.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I have an older brother, John, an older sister, Rita, a younger brother, Kevin, and a younger sister, Nancy.
So you're right in the middle of the five of them.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now,
good
where
place to be.
Yes, indeed. Sheltered a little bit. Protected on both sides.
I guess.
Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in the Pittsburgh area?
I grew up in North Huntington Township, which is about 25 miles east of Pittsburgh.
Okay, very pretty part of the world. Tell me about growing up there.
Well, we grew up in the country on a dirt road, as a matter of fact. So we enjoyed living that way. We had a very nice garden, which we tended. We learned to play baseball and football on the sand lot. Had some real cold winters, a lot of snow. Went to Catholic elementary school through eighth grade, and then went to a public junior high and high school. Great place to grow up.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. Now, was your father involved in the Second World War at all?
No, he had to defer it because of his employment.
Yeah, that's what I probably would have assumed there. Okay, cool. So you went to a Catholic school, you said, up through eighth grade? Yeah. And what about high school? Where did you go to high school?
I went to Nolan High School, N-O-R-W-I-N High School, which is in Irwin, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty large high school. I think we had probably 350 or so in our senior class.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the high school experience for you. What sort of subjects did you gravitate to?
Well, I was not a mathematician, so I did much better in the arts side of the house than the sciences. So I was editor of the yearbook. I did play junior varsity football and baseball. I liked English, history, geography, those type of subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoyed reading a lot.
Mm-hmm. Growing up at this time in the young fella in the 1940s and 50s and the 60s, the dominant theme in politics, international politics especially, is the Cold War. And that affected a lot of folks in their everyday lives in a variety of different ways. What do you remember about growing up during the Cold War?
Well, it's interesting. I remember my mother had five siblings, and one of them was an Army Air Corps officer. And I guess this was in 54 maybe, so I was 10 years old, and he came by our home on his way to Korea. And he was an artillery spotter pilot, and he got killed in Korea. And I remember they brought his body home, and we were going to his funeral at Arlington, and it was in the dead of winter. I believe it was in February, and it was snowing, and we were on the turnpike headed that way, and the car hit a curb at one of the rest stops, and it broke the axle, so we didn't get to go to his funeral, which was, I didn't think too much about it then, but it was pretty hard on my mom. But in any case, I did get to see his grave in Arlington, and it's not too far from where John F. Kennedy's buried the same hillside. So I remember that. I don't recall doing too much of this stuff and getting under the desk and all that kind of stuff. We didn't do too much of that in school. I didn't pay much attention to the politics up until maybe the 60s when the space race was going on. I think I was a senior or a junior in high school when Sputnik went up, but that was pretty interesting.
You know, you mentioned Kennedy and growing up Catholic in the East. I wonder what your thoughts or your family's thoughts on Kennedy were.
My father was a Democrat in the early years of his life, but he slowly moved to the Republican side of the political scheme. And I don't think he thought too much of the Kennedy family, frankly. He thought John F. Kennedy's father was a bootlegger, and so on and so forth. So he wasn't enamored with them, and you know, the religious side of it really didn't much come into play. It was his political views that, I mean, he just didn't want to sign off on too much of that liberalism. But Kennedy's liberalism is nowhere near what we have today.
that's for sure. Things have certainly changed. What about you? Your views on Kennedy?
I didn't think too much about him being in office. The Cuban crisis was sort of an interesting event to come through, and at the time of it, I thought, well, this is going to be a bad deal. It worked out eventually, but I think that was probably one of the best things he was able to do in his tenure. The Bay of Pigs was a whole different story.
Yeah.
But he was assassinated when I was, I guess, a freshman in college, and LBJ took over, and the next thing you know, the Vietnam thing was really starting to cook.
You mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you would have been, an age where these kind of things would be more likely than previous to being, on your radar, on your scope a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the days and the events around that?
Well, I do. We didn't have the television access we had today, but the news was pretty up on it, and I can remember the tensions, particularly in Florida, with the military movements that they had going on down there. And I couldn't see in my mind how this thing was going to evolve. We had troops on the beaches or whatever, and we were going to invade Cuba, so on and so forth. But I think I was more busy with school than I was with the news at that time.
Yeah, sure. When did you graduate from high school? What year? 63?
Graduated in 62.
Okay, in 1962. All right. So what was on your, what were your plans for moving forward? Did you want to go to college? Were you looking for a vocation? What did you hope to do?
Well, I did want to go to college, and my older brother, John, was attending the Citadel at that time. And I was not really too studious. I mean, I made good grades, but I was not a Harvard candidate. So I didn't apply to any other schools in the Citadel for some reason and ended up going there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well,
and
tell me about
so
this.
My younger brother went there also.
Yeah. Tell me about this time there. It's a very prestigious school in a lot of different ways. Tell me about your time at the Citadel.
Well, in 1962 was a very hard school.
I'm sure.
being a plebe was a year of learning. But at that time, they believed that they break you down so that you know what it's like to be on the bottom, and that way you learn how to lead. So I went through the police system, and became a non-commissioned officer in the Corps. But I had a whole different viewpoint of the type of police system that they needed to develop these kids. So I probably wasn't as hard on them as maybe some of the other people. Because there's a point of it, in some of it, that a lot of it, there's no point in it. It gets to where it doesn't produce any results.
Yeah. Well, can you go into some detail on that? I think that's very interesting.
Well, it's a physical challenge, number one. So, you spend a lot of time doing push-ups. And you're pretty much low man on the totem pole. You have to walk on the gutter. You can walk on the sidewalk. You have to keep your chin in at all times. At the mess halls, you had to serve the upperclassmen. You had to be prepared to give them current events when they called on you at the dinner table. You had to know what they called was plea knowledge, so all kinds of inane facts about the school and the history of buildings and cannons and monuments and things like that. And you had to be on your toes. Of course, you had to be heavy brass and shoes polished to the nth degree. You had to have your room in order. I mean, it helped me a lot in having discipline, which I probably needed, to know how to utilize your time. And so from that point of view, it was real helpful. Being a Yankee wasn't necessarily too helpful, but we did have quite a few folks down there from Pittsburgh, most of them on athletic teams. But it was an interesting year. It went by in a real hurry. My grades weren't really good, so I ended up going to summer school. By the start of my sophomore year, I was beginning to figure out how to study and not worry too much about shiny shoes.
Right.
So that was good. And of course, the military side of it was really, really helpful. I was proud to be a cadet. It gives you a sense of patriotism that maybe you wouldn't develop at another campus. Had many, many graduates who had already been to Vietnam, and at that time they were mostly MACV or Special Forces type, and you had a couple of them who had already been killed over there, and that was in 63.
You mentioned that your idea of leadership, I guess, or how to deal with different from those who came before you. In what ways were your ideas about this different from those, and how did it manifest itself?
I didn't think it was necessary to continually push them physically and mentally. I mean, at some point in time, you've done all you can in that regard. I was more interested in making sure that they got their good grades that they needed to stay in school, because I didn't want to see any of them leave school because they couldn't do the physical part of it,
yeah,
or the mental part. But there are some people who did anyway. You can't, that can't be helped. It just happens. But a lot of people, they just feel some sense of power over someone when they're in that position, and then never, I just didn't feel that was necessary. Want to make sure that they got good grades, so I was the academic officer for the company because of that.
Right.
And I think you can earn someone's respect by treating them properly in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What was your major field of study? What sort of things did you like to learn about when you were in BMI?
Well, at the Citadel, I studied political science. That was my major, and I was interested mostly in transportation.
I'm sorry, I said BMI.
Yeah,
that's
all right. I'll let that slip. I won't hold that against you.
Yeah, well, you probably should. I'm sorry. Say that again. I missed that.
I majored in political science.
Oh, okay.
Which kept me from the dread of mathematics and science.
Right.
So it was. I had for some reason thought I might be a lawyer at one point in time, but I was really interested in transportation, primarily because of the railroads and the things in Pittsburgh that I grew up with, and my dad was kind of in that business.
So
I actually wrote my senior paper on mass transportation while I was at the city.
So, you know, being at this school and ROTC and this interest in transportation, is this something that you wanted to pursue once you left school?
Well, yeah, ironically, it was. At that time, most everybody who had a ROTC contract ended up going right into service. There was no, that's 60 days and then you go home. So when you were a senior, you had, at least on the Army side, you had to make a selection of what branch you wanted to go to in the Army. And you had to pick two combat arms and one non-combat arms. So, I knew I didn't want to be an infantryman. So I picked armor because I didn't think they had a whole lot of tanks running around in Vietnam. And I think I picked air defense artillery for some strange reason. And then for the non-combat arms, I picked transportation corps, being so naive as to think that, you know, what do they do over there? Well, that was a big mistake. But in any case, I ended up with a transportation corps.
Oh, okay.
Which was good.
Well, I wonder, what did you know about what was going on in Vietnam?
Well,
62,
we,
63, 64.
In our, in 65 and 66, almost all of our military science classes dealt with Vietnam and what was going on over there and the tactics. And, at that time, they hadn't started the big buildup, but they were lining up for it. So we would have people come in who had already been there, and they would tell us about their experiences, who were Citadel guys. And, of course, our active Army professors had their thoughts and perspectives also. So we were pretty well up on it.
Do you remember any of the details or anything that they were telling you about it, about the way the war was being fought, what the background of it was, and how we were approaching
it
there?
At that time, they were talking about, it was more of a military assistance mission than it was an out-and-out, let's go after them. So they were talking mostly about trying to train up the Montagnards yards in the Vietnamese Army to take care of the hamlets and the cities. But, of course, at that time, I don't think we had anywhere enough advisors to meet that mission. So the further away you got from Saigon, the harder it became to influence the minds and the will of the people. And, you know, we couldn't win them over that way. The special forces were heavily involved, but they just didn't have the numbers from what they were telling us to do what they had to do. So it was a battle of the, you know, the North Vietnamese and Vietnam were trying to do the same thing. You know, I think they had the advantage because they knew the lay of the land.
Right. It must have been really interesting, I would think, to be a student at the Citadel, knowing that Vietnam could very well be in your future, and talking with these folks who had been over there at the early stages. That must have been very enlightening, I would think.
Well, it was. It was sort of scary, to be honest with you. Not knowing, well, we did know. I don't think there was any doubt in my mind I was going to get it off. Just a question of when. Because my brother had gone over. He graduated. My brother graduated in 63. He went over in 65 as a forward observer for the Big Red One. And then he came back in September of that time, they wouldn't allow two brothers from the same family to be in the country at the same time. So he came home, and next thing you know, I'm getting ready to go. So I knew it was inevitable, but I was ready to do it. I mean, that was part of the deal I made with him when I took my commission.
Right.
I didn't know whether I wanted to be a career Army officer. I wasn't really too sure about that. Whereas my brother was, it's what he wanted to do. So, I graduated in May of 66, was commissioned the same day, and went on active duty in November.
So, November of 1966, active duty.
Right.
Where do you go first once you finish the Citadel?
Well, when I finished the Citadel, I spent my summer at home, just waiting on my orders. I was selected for Transportation Corps, which I said, well, that's good.
You knew that immediately then?
Right.
Okay.
Because the day I graduated, that's where they told me I was going. They just didn't tell me when. So I went home to Pittsburgh and worked a summer job, and then in November I reported to Fort Eustis, Virginia, which is outside of Newport News, and that was the home of the Transportation School, Transportation Corps, excuse me. So I ended up there in November for the officer's basic course, and I think, I'm trying to remember, I think we had maybe 45 other second lieutenants in that class. So that was a 90-day basic course that, you know, every branch has for their officers. And you know, you learn tactics and how to run convoys and what the Transportation Corps does with railroads and boats. They had their own boats all over the place in Vietnam, tugboats, river boats, and they ran the ports over there, for instance. But they were mostly involved in running convoys, which I soon learned was a very hazardous business.
Yeah, of course.
And there again, they brought officers back who had been to Vietnam, who had been running convoys, to teach some of those classes. So, I said, well, that's real interesting, but I don't think I want to be a truck company officer. But I wouldn't have any choice, and I didn't know what I was going to end up doing. But in any case, you learned the basics, military courtesy, how to dress, how to react, how to plan convoys, how to run quartz, load cargo, things like that. And a couple of weeks doing field training where you go out and play defenses and dig foxholes and things like that, and weapons training, compass courses, pretty much basic stuff, which was good. But I think in December they started coming down, which they called them levies, I think. Time where they would start giving out assignments to lieutenants. So most all of them went into truck-related activities. I guess at least 30 of the class. A number of them went into port operations. Cameron Bay was a gigantic port there, and Transportation Corps was involved in that. A number of them went into running the larks, which were the watercraft that transportation loaded cargo and came across beaches and things of that nature. They called them larks. Vehicles that floated in the water. Amphibious type operations. And the Army also had tugboats and LSTs, so some of them went into the watercraft side of the house. And I didn't get my assignment until all of the other ones had gone. The class ended in, end of January of 67. The school's over, and everybody had graduated and gone their own ways, and there were two of us left. A fellow named Tom Path from Indiana and myself. And we said, well, I don't know what we did not to get an assignment. We either boneheads or they're going to send us home. So, sure enough, the 1st of February, I got a call from Fort Bragg told me that my orders would be coming through and that I would be going to the 608 Aviation Company, which was an aircraft direct support maintenance outfit, getting ready to deploy at Fort Bragg. And Tom Path was assigned to the, gosh, I'm trying to think what it was now, 395th Transportation Company, I'm not sure, but he was type of assignment as technical supply officers in non-rated crew member status. Well, I didn't know anything about aviation, much less technical supply. But I said, well, this is really going to be another interesting trip. And the day after, I got the call from Fort Bragg, the commanding officer called me, and his name was that time Major Art Bowden, and he was a A&M graduate. He said, he didn't know anything about me, he said, but he looked at the list of candidates coming out of that basic class, and he said, there was one guy from the Citadel. He said, that's why I picked you. So I said, well, thank you so much, since he was an A&M guy.
Right.
But he was a great, great commander.
Now, are you going to go through any sort of supply training before you?
Well, I did.
Okay.
I left Fort Eustis, maybe second week of February, and it ended up at Fort Lee, Virginia, which was at that time the quartermaster's school, which did supply functions, but they had a special school for aviation maintenance units. And a technical supply in aviation is a pretty big job because you have thousands of line items of repair parts that you have to keep in stock to support your maintenance function. And the Army had started a program using an NCR 500 computer, early computer, not early, but for that time it was pretty early, to keep track of all these parts. It was mechanized system.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the past they used to have to keep them on little 3x5 cars. This was done on a computer. So it took care of all your management, receipts, issues, stocking, all that kind of stuff. So I went to school there for about 45 days to learn the supply system for aviation maintenance. And while I was there, my platoon sergeant and the rest of the platoon were going through the course to learn how to run the computer. So I got to meet those folks while I was there. That was pretty interesting, too. My platoon sergeant was an E6 named Will Copeland. And he was a career NCO, black belt, as a matter of fact. He and Arm was the biggest trees, bulky, strong looking guy. And I went in to meet him for the first time. He was in class in Cincinnati and shook my hands. He looked at me, I looked in his eyes, and he says, well, I got a second lieutenant to worry about. But he told me early on, he said that if we work together, I'm going to get you through Vietnam. I respect you as an officer, but you got to let me lead the men too, which was good advice.
Yeah.
And we developed a really, really good friendship. He's a good man.
So you had this this contact who you're going to be working with all the way back at Fort Lee then?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's really handy, because that oftentimes you hear
because the unit was at Fort Bragg. They had been scheduled to deploy a year earlier, but they just couldn't get everything together to do that. It was a big unit. It was 289 people. Had a major as a company commander, which is pretty unusual. So it had two majors, a captain, two lieutenants, and six warrant officers. All of them were rated except me. All of them were aviators except me. And then all the enlisted folks that went down. We had a maintenance platoon. We had a supply platoon. We had an avionics section, which was for the navigation radios. We had a quality control section and production control. So we made, it was a direct support maintenance unit, so they did pretty heavy maintenance all the way to airframe repair and engine replacements, down to just fixing instruments. So they were getting ready to deploy at Fort Bragg for a year. So I was the last officer to come aboard, and I got there in early April, I guess. They were just packing up. Everything was going into containers and boxes and all that kind of stuff. So it was not much training going on. It was all deployment.
Yeah. Sounds like they were ready to roll, just kind of waiting on you, as it were.
Well, yeah, I would say so. They were leaving in June, so I had about a month and a half to get acclimated and get my feet on the ground. We didn't do any kind of supply functions. We were just too busy getting everything ready to go, making sure we had all the equipment that we were supposed to have, and a lot of them we didn't have, it wasn't available. It would have to come later on. But we spent a lot of time flying around the country to different aviation-related posts, trying to scrounge up stuff that we needed for the operation. And I was, took me maybe a month and a half to get to know my guys, and they were quite a collection. All of them were younger than me except Sergeant Copeland, and they were from all over the country. A couple of them had college degrees, but most all of them were draftees. They were pretty smart guys, being computers at that point in time.
I wonder if you might be able to describe this computer system. Definitely be of interest to someone.
The the computer system was housed in two millmans, which are on wheels, you know, trailers, 35 foot trailers. They had the computers in one, and they had the printers and the card indexes on the other side, the other trailer. And it came with a big 5 kW generator because it had to be air conditioned. So that isn't too bad. I'm going to Vietnam, at least I'm going to have an air conditioner. So that was the heart and soul of the operation. But we also had all the repair parts. And they were being sent to us from the Army Aviation Depot, and I think it was Corpus Christi. And they were coming in Konex containers. And a Konex container is an 8x8. Made out of metal that had shells in it that had all the repair parts. And you can imagine opening two doors of a container and walking down a little aisle, and on either side you had shells built. And there could be 500 different little shells in there, from washers and nuts and bolts to wheels to you name it. Any kind of part that you would see on any of the Army aircraft. And we had fixed wing helicopter. So we had a lot of aircraft to keep.
Well, you would have too, yeah.
And we had rotor blades, engine boxes. I mean, it was a big, big operation. So it was a humongous amount of equipment that was going to be shipped to meet us there when we got there. So I didn't get much exposure to the computer other than what happened at Fort Lee, and that was very, very little. So all my learning was on the job when we got to Vietnam. But in any case, we got the unit prepared to go, and we had a lot of vehicles. I guess we had maybe 75 vehicles from some trailers and Jeeps and whatever that belonged to the unit, and then had to go out of Charleston on a ship. So it's my job, of course, as a second lieutenant, to convoy that down to Charleston. Well, there again, my Fort Houston training failed me. Because I was a convoy commander, and we hadn't even made it off of Fort Bragg, and the convoy had gone in four different sections. It was just a fiasco.
Oh, no.
And it was pouring rain, and it was probably a six-hour trip because they didn't have the interstate, and it was all two-lane road from once you got into South Carolina down to Charleston. But luckily, I was familiar with Charleston, so I knew where I was going. I was just praying that everybody else knew where they were going. But by the grace of God, we all made it to the Army Depot in Charleston pretty much the same time. I don't know how that happened. And nobody was in any accidents. Nobody was injured. But that NCO that was on Fort Bragg, he said, I don't know how you did it, but he sure made lemonade out of something else. I was lucky, but we got that all into Charleston, and we had four enlisted guys who would accompany that little cargo on this cargo ship to go to Vietnam, even out of Charleston. And that was, I can't remember the day, but it was in June. So they got on board and they left. We went back to Vietnam, I mean, back to Fort Bragg. And we sat around for a week while the Transportation Corps again got us transportation. Out to Tacoma, Washington, where we would board a troop ship. So late mid-June, we flew out there in three sections to Tacoma to get on board the troop ship Tiger. And we went in three sections, the first two sections. I think one of them left at 9 in the morning, the other at 12, and this is out of Fort Bragg. Airplane. And it was a old DC Constellation. Had big old three tail fins on the rear, a skinny looking thing. Looked like a Greyhound propeller airplane. And I was on board that with three warrant officers and Colonel Major Bowden. He said, you want to get in the back of this plane because if you get up near the wings, you're not going to get any rest because those engines are off the So I got a good seat in the back and kind of slept on the way out there. And as luck would have it, the plane developed mechanical problems and we had to land in St. Louis to get the engine problem fixed. And we finally arrived out at night, and they helped ship for us, of course. So I stumbled to get them. They was really cool. But I found my room, which was a little stateroom, but it had three bunks, one on one side and bunk on the other side, of course. I was the last guy to get there, so I managed to make as much noise as I could getting in there just to wake those two other guys up. But that began the long, tedious voyage to Vietnam.
Let me ask you here, Mr. McKeever, if I may. You knew that you were going to Vietnam. This was no secret for you. You had a brother who had gone and had come back. What were your thoughts on leaving? I mean, here we're looking at the summer of 1967. The war's been in full swing for quite a while now. There are news reports coming back. Your brother's back. You have other veterans, as you talked about, coming back in training. What are your thoughts about leaving to go to the war zone now?
Well, of course, I was apprehensive. And I had, you know, I certainly didn't want to leave my fiance behind, which was pretty difficult. But, you know, we had agreed early on that if I was going to Vietnam, I did not want to be married and leave a widow behind.
Mm-hmm.
And we came to that agreement. It was tough, but we did. She was doing college, so she would have that year to finish her schooling, and I would be away. I was apprehensive from the point of view, and I wasn't comfortable in the situation because I hadn't been around in the aviation side of the house until now, and I had a lot to learn. I mean, it's one thing to fly, but then you have to support at least 400 of the aircraft in the theater of war, which is a big job, and they were pushing aircraft in there heavy on. But by the same point of view, I was really happy that I was in that unit because the warrant officers took me under their wing, and they were great tutors from the maintenance side of the house, and developing an understanding of the production control and how you needed to work all that into the requirements of the unit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was being schooled the whole time, and these warrant officers were some of the oldest aviation warrant officers in the country because they had been in Army aviation and helicopters primarily since the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So they were really, really knowledgeable people.
Yeah, a lot of experience there.
They were. From that point of view, I felt comfortable that I'd be okay. And of course, I had a lot of confidence in Sergeant Copeland. And the fact that he had already been in the military for 15 years. So I knew he understood how to handle the men. So I wasn't concerned about dying or anything of that nature. I mean, happened, but I felt a lot better than being a truck company platoon leader, for sure.
Yeah.
One of the big unknowns was where we were going to be stationed, whether we were going to be a bad place or not so bad place. And as it ended up, the unit was going to be stationed at a place called Dong Bat Tin, which was maybe 10 kilometers north of Cameron Bay and 25 kilometers south of Nha Trang, right on the China Sea. And it had a corrugated steel runway there, maybe 1,500, 2,000 feet. And the 18th Engineer Brigade had their headquarters there. So it was not an undeveloped area.
Yeah.
They were building it up pretty quick. When we got in there, they already had they were completing our hangars, and so we were able to move into those and get started.
Let me ask you about this trip over on the Geiger first. This is not 2 days later you're at Cameron Bay. This is going to be a long trip, and you're not a sailor.
No.
Take me on this trip.
Well, it wasn't the Royal Caribbean, I can guarantee you that. The Geiger was late 49-50 year troop ship, which the last I knew of was the State of Maine Maritime Academy training vessel. But it was a troop ship. It was built to carry troops. And it had been brought out of mothballs and put into service to move folks to Magnus for voyage, accommodated about 800 troops, and of course the officers had their quarters, which were pretty nice. They were up on the upper side of the deck, and junior officers had 3-year room, and then senior officers had a 2-year room, but that was the troops were bunked down on the hatch covers under the holds, and the cargo was stowed underneath the hatch covers, and then the hatch cover was put down, and then the troops put all their gear, cool bags, on the hatch covers. But they slept underneath the wings of the hatches, so they were sleeping, I think, six high. Didn't have a lot of room in there, and it was not very comfortable. They had, you know, little spring beds with mattresses on them, but you could barely turn over. So our unit had we had two holds for all our guys, and then we also had on that ship a battalion of the Big Red One. And we had some other ashen trash units that were going over. So there again, being a second lieutenant, I was proud to be the so I had to maintain all troop departments for our unit. I had to go in there every day and inspect it, because you weren't allowed to put anything up on the bulkheads or on your bunk. You might fall off and kick the guy to tell you. Every day to make sure all that was dress right dress, and that was kind of interesting to do that, make sure that nobody was dying of typhoid fever, that the seasick guys were getting attention, which there were quite a few.
Yeah. What about you?
It didn't bother me a bit. I was in a room with a porthole, and I could go. I was up on deck, but when you're down in that hold, it's dark down there. For us,
all right, I just turned the recorder back on. Sorry about that technological snafu.
That's probably my fault.
Anyway,
in any case, the troops had a rough voyage over there. Officers had it pretty good, I thought. It was interesting that in the morning they had, at least on the officer's side, they had a little cabin steward that came by who had this little three-note xylophone, and it would go doom, 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 doom to wake you up. You didn't have any revelry. You just played that little tune, and that meant you had to go get ready to eat. So the officer's mess was really nice. We had tables which sat six folks. And they had china and linen napkins and silverware and menus. And, I mean, you ate well, believe me. Whereas the enlisted guys, that was a little different story. They had of course, they had a big kitchen on the ship, but the chow was served in the mess kits, and then they had to go find a place to eat, whether it was up on deck or in the dining area. And they didn't quite have a menu. They sort of had a fixed meal. Everybody ate the same thing, and if you didn't like it, too bad.
Right.
But it was an interesting trip, because we left Tacoma and sailed out on the Puget Sound, and that was a long sail just to get out of that sound. I didn't realize it was such a long distance up there. Beautiful, beautiful views when I woke up the next morning. So it took almost a day just to get out into the open ocean. And we headed out, and we hadn't gone 3 days when one of the soldiers developed appendicitis, and he had to be evacuated from the ship. So we headed toward Hawaii, and they sent a helicopter out to take that guy off the boat. And then we went on across the ocean to Guam to refuel. And of course, out in the ocean, it's I'd never been in the middle of the ocean, so it was interesting just passing the days watching the dolphin were around the boat a lot of time out there in the middle of the ocean. And at night you would see the fluorescent water from the algae or whatever it is that has fluorescence in it, at night. The days were hot. So you read a lot, write a lot of letters, and wish the time would go by faster. You crossed an international date line, which was a fun thing because you get inducted into the Society of Neptune or somebody like that. I'm not sure what they called it, but in any case, you have to go up on the deck, and they have Neptune up there with his king and his court, and they throw mustard on you and mayonnaise and food at you and get inducted into the Society for crossing the international dayline. That was kind of fun. And enlisted guys like that, you get a chance to mess up with officers.
Right.
So we ended up in Guam to refuel, and kind of interesting going in there. There were two or three Russian ships outside in the international waters watching all the traffic going into Guam, as well as the bombers flying out of there. You know, these ships they had out there, they had, must have had 30 antennas on each one of them.
Yeah,
they weren't fishing ships, that's for sure. So we tied up at Guam, and we got in there late at night. So in the morning they gave everybody shore leave just to get off and stretch your legs. There wasn't a lot to do on Guam. It's just kind of a piece of dirt out in the middle of the ocean, from what I could tell. A lot of big lizards. Not too many tourist attractions there. So we were able to find the officers' club that the Navy used, and able to get a couple of beers there, which was nice. And the troops, they had an enlisted club where they could get some near beer, too. Loaded us all back up the next day, and off we went through the Philippines, which was pretty neat. We didn't stop in the Philippines, but we went through the islands, and I was amazed at how desolate those islands were. They're just beautiful, all green jungles, very little civilization, the ones that I saw. And those water routes through there, they weren't very wide. I mean, they were probably at the most half mile wide. We sailed right on through there, came out on the other side, and there was an aircraft carrier out there waiting on us, as well as, I think it was a destroyer that came up with us into Vietnam, into Vung Tau.
Okay, so you came into Vung Tau.
Yeah. And we arrived there early in the morning. I guess it was maybe 6 o'clock, and the sun hadn't even come up. But when it came up, there was a tugboat alongside, an Army tugboat, by the way. Transportation Corps.
Of course.
And on the back of it, on the deck, they had a big old shark laying there. And they pulled up alongside and hooked up and brought us in to where we dropped anchor. And the Saigon River drains out at Vung Tau. And one of the first things we saw were human body remains floating out.
Really?
Tide. Pretty gross.
Any idea where they came from, what the story was?
I'm sorry?
Did you have any idea where they could have come from or what the story was behind them?
No, we just figured they were casualties of war. I mean, that's a pretty big river and it's a big delta, so, you know, we didn't have any idea, but it was not a pretty sight.
Yeah.
So there, the big red one guys got off onto lighter barges and off they went to Coochie, I think is where they were headquartered for their build up. And we pulled up anchor and headed up to Cameron Bay where we were discharged.
Okay, so you were up at Cameron Bay after what? Probably 3 weeks or a month?
No, we dropped anchor in Cameron Bay, got off the boat onto a barge, which they took right over to the dock at Cameron Bay. what was interesting is Cameron Bay, they had a container crane and a Sealand ship in. And Sealand was a container ship at that time. That was at the very, very start of the containerization era in shipping. But Sealand had a contract with the DOD to move supplies into Vietnam. So here they were at the dock unloading supplies in containers, pretty good-sized operation that, again, the Transportation Corps was running. So we got off at Cameron Bay, and they loaded us in the back of Dusenhaz and took us up to Don Bhutin, which was a 10-12 kilometer ride across the bay and up Highway 1 into our new surroundings at Don Bhutin.
I wonder if you might describe these new surroundings for me. What was what was the lay of the land? What did this place look like?
Well, it was flat as could be, flat as a pancake. Highway 1, of course, the main highway on the coast of South Vietnam, ran right through the middle of what was the Army compound there. On our side, we had the engineers and the aviation companies, which included a Chinook outfit. And on the other side of the highway, we had two assault helicopter companies, which we supported. The barracks were wood barracks with tin roofs, wood halfway up, and then screened the rest of the way up. And they had 55-gallon drums of sand around all the walls for protection from any kind of mortar fragments that would come through at that level. So, of course, your bunks were down below the sides of the drums. Had a mess hall. All the latrines were outside, which were 3-4 haulers, and they were pretty nasty. You had to do your business into a cut-off 55-gallon drum, and then every day somebody had to pull that out and put diesel fuel in it in the area and burn it off, which we were able to tolerate for a while, and it was pretty bad. The officers' quarters were about the same. I mean, we didn't have anything different from the enlisted folks at that time. And they were still putting in the road network and building our hangars. The runways were okay. They had an air traffic control tower there that was owned by a small unit. The roads were dusty as could be. It was no way to keep the dust down. It was so dry over there. But I remember the second night we got in, we were waiting for our cargo ship to arrive. It hadn't arrived yet. It was about 2 days behind us. But the first night we were in, we were outside just talking, and some mortar fire started from our side, from the engineer side, sending up flares on across the highway. And there were some Viet Cong out there trying to get through a perimeter, which was, our security was provided by the Korean Army. So they maintained all that security out there. But they were trying to get in, so they called in the gunship, Smokey. And you could see him flying around it, but you could hardly hear him. But every once in a while, you'd see like a red laser light shoot down to the ground from up in the air. And you just knew that somebody was getting their butt chewed up. And that went on for about an hour, and was the end of it. So I said, well, I guess we're here for sure now.
Yeah, that's a welcome to Vietnam kind of moment, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Welcome home.
Yeah. So but, there you are. You found yourself at your new base with a new unit. The next day, or maybe even that day, work begins. What's the point? What are you guys doing there?
Well, the first thing we had to do was we had to unload that cargo ship and get everything brought up to our vocation, and we had a window where we had to be operational. They gave us, I think they gave us 30 days, but Major Bowen said, I want this thing up and running in 20 days after we get everything in. Well, that was a 24/7 operation, get that cargo off the docks and up to our location, and to get the computers in and get it up and running, because we had to download all the data of the... You still there?
Yes, sir.
We had to download the data from all the materials that was shipped to us. That's how we started our database. They sent us data on tape drives, as a matter of fact. So we were busy getting our tech supply inventory into the computer and making sure we had everything broken open and ready to go. And I left that up to Sergeant Copeland. Meanwhile, I was traveling to two different aviation units that had already been in country to find out how they were operating. So I had to go down to Coochie to see how Tom Paff's unit was set up, and then come back and put some of that to work in our unit. So I was flying a little bit around the country while they were getting organized with that, and that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. What all places did you go to?
Well, I went down to Coochie for the first trip, and we were flying in there. Colonel Major Bowen was flying. He said, I'm not staying. I'm going to let you off, and I'll come back and get you in the morning. So, of course, we flew into Coochie, and before we, the aviation maintenance was on the far end of the runway, and we were picking up a small arms fire going in there, and he threw me out and said, you go find a unit, I'm getting out of here, and he left. So I found a unit and got with Tom, and we spent the night there, but it was not a lot of fun because they were under mortar attack almost every night, so you'd have to get up and go find a bunker outside the hooch and crawl in there and wait for that to end and get back up and try to get some sleep. So I was really pleased to get out of there. And then we went to a unit up toward Da Nang, which was pretty interesting because Da Nang was a gigantic operation. That's where the Marines were working. And spent some time there, but it was pretty secure area.
You mentioned this mortar attack here down at Coochie. What is it like for you to be so new in country and to be facing one of these things for the first time?
Well, I just kind of followed Tom's lead. I said, you know, wherever you go, I'm going. I'm going to be there right beside you, so don't stop because I'll kill you. I'm walking over you. No, that was the first thing he said. This is where we, if they start firing, wherever they're impacting, this is where we're going. And it was just a sandbag bunker. Wasn't in the ground, it was above ground. Corrugated steel roof with sandbags piled on top of it. I suspect if it got hit with a mortar shell, you'd probably survive.
Yeah.
But you'd sure have a headache. But I was just thinking about something you asked me earlier about heading to Vietnam before we left. And one of my roommates at the Citadel, a boy named Johnny Fuller, was a Marine Corps officer who had been commissioned the same day I was. And he went to Quantico for his Marine basic course, and then he was sent to Vietnam about the time I came on active duty. And he was killed there in November of 66. And he was the first Citadel graduate to be awarded the Navy Cross for heroism. And I had to go to his funeral. I didn't have to go. I did go. I wanted to go. In Atlanta in March of 67. And his mother had died when he was youngster, so he was raised by his dad. And Johnny was the ultimate Marine, I'm telling you what. He was really a leader at the Citadel, even. He was our company executive officer and just all around great guy. But that was a pretty sad affair to have to attend that. And I said, boy, that, to me, I just said that's such a waste of a good person. So back to Don Batin. We got set up and we got into operation in about 15 days or so. So we were receiving aircraft that needed maintenance, and we were issuing supply parts to units that needed supply parts. And one of the really great lessons that I learned from Major Bowden about leadership was he got officers together in the officer's hooch, and he said, I know that y'all are missing your families and thinking about home. He said, but we got to think about other things. He said, we can't let that interfere with our mission here. He said, we're going to fix this officer's quarters up. We're going to do it right. And he told me, he said, the reason we're doing this is to keep your mind off of all that other stuff. He said, it's fine to think about it, but you don't want to be thinking about it 24/7. So he said, first thing we're going to do is we're going to build us an officer's club here that nobody could match. And we did. We had the best officer's club in, within 300-400 miles.
It must have been nice to have the engineers there with you.
Well, they didn't do it. We did it ourselves.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. But we had a warrant officer, O.B. England, who was probably the best scrounger I ever met in my life. And being in the aviation company, we had access to things that other people didn't have. We had sheet metal. We had stainless steel. We had all kinds of stuff that you could trade. So Obi would be, he'd go out and he'd come to me and say, I need some sheets of aluminum. I said, well, I mean, he said, eight. So I'd give him 8 sheets of aluminum. And he'd come back with a truckload of plywood or 2 toilets, 3 toilets. I mean, whatever. He traded for some furniture for Major Bowden's office that only general officers were supposed to have. I don't know how he did it. Refrigerators, air conditioners, this guy was. He was fine and everything. So we ended up building our officer's bar.
Tell me about this officer's club. I wanna hear about this.
Well, when we came in there, of course, it was just, you know, the building was wood halfway up and then screen all the way up the rest of the way. So we added on this addition. It was wood, completely enclosed, so that we could air condition it. And we put plywood on the walls. And believe it or not, I don't know who came up with the idea that we needed to do something with this plywood. We didn't want to paint it. We wanted to make it look nice. So they said, what we're going to do is we're going to get these gas torches that they used in the maintenance building, and we're going to char the plywood. Well, have you ever tried to char an 8-4-way piece of plywood with a blowtorch? It's hot, and it's stinky, and it's smelly, and it takes forever. But we did it. Every wall was charred. It was kind of interesting. It looked like some, I don't know, bayou, I guess. But we did the walls, and then we built a bar. So we had a full bar, and we had refrigerators in there to keep the beer in. And of course, we got liquor. You could buy liquor over there. And we had a patio out there with a 55-gallon drum made into a charcoal grill where we could cook on. And of course, Chief Warrant Officer England had a connection with the Navy guys down at Cameron Bay, and the Navy always eats well if they don't do anything else. And he would come back with boxes of frozen steaks, which we would put into the freezer, and then we would have steak cookouts when we wanted to have a party. And all the donut dollars the Red Cross girls loved come there because they'd get a steak to eat.
I'm sure.
Have nice air-conditioned evening in our officers' rooms. And then we finished the rest of the building off so that each officer had his own enclosed room. We walled it all the way up and put air conditioning in there, so we had air conditioners. Small units, but if you had enough of them, you could do it. And then we put in our own restroom. So we had probably one of the few flushing toilet arrangements in the area, and a hot shower, which we built. So it was really, really comfortable. We got rid of all that outhouse business.
Right.
We didn't tell the engineers because they probably wouldn't have allowed us to put a septic tank in, but we got it in the ground.
So. Where did you find a septic tank?
We built it out of...
Oh, is that right?
We dug a hole and put in the field lines and ran the stuff to the septic tank.
Huh.
Just, everything was scrounged, like the toilets and the showers, and the hot water came from the big old, it was actually a water tank, a fuel bladder off a jet airplane we got a camera on, and put it up on the tower so that during the day it was heated by the sun. At night you'd had enough for, it wasn't a terribly hot shower, but it was warm anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it beat the heck out of cold showers.
Right.
So that was a great improvement. So whenever you were at home at Don Matin, we lived pretty good.
Yeah.
We had an excellent mess hall, really great mess officer, and always had nice food, because when Obie scrounged, he didn't scrounge only for us, but he scrounged for the rest of the unit.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to get our fresh vegetables from the lot, which was in the mountains directly west of us, probably, I don't know, it was a half hour or so helicopter flight.
Mm-hmm.
Up in the mountains.
Yeah, kind of a resort town at one time.
It is. It is right now. It's beautiful. My wife was there 3 years ago. She visited Vietnam, and I told her to go to Da Lat, which is a tourist town. It's beautiful. Matter of fact, Vietnam is beautiful. I'd go back in a heartbeat. So we would fly up there every 3 days and get fresh vegetables so that the guys would have those to eat. And in addition to the whatever rations that they would draw on a normal basis. So they were well fed, and that was important to us. To help them around, because there wasn't,
right,
wasn't a whole lot to do other than work and go to bed. But, you know, unless they had their day run, we had our officers' club. So they had that, and then there was a group that brought books around from libraries. They weren't Red Cross, because they were another group. So they always had that. They had some movies that the engineers had, a little movie theater, outdoor movie theater, that they would run movies at night when they could. We were too far away from Cameron for us to go over there every day. It wasn't, you couldn't take your troops over there, that's for sure. So they were pretty much stuck at Don Batun. But they had to pull guard duty, just like everybody else. We had, on our side of the road, we had our own security. We didn't have Koreans. They were on the other side with the aviation and the Special Forces Company. So we had our own guard posts, and we did guard duty along with the engineers. And we had a water point, which was about two clicks north of our compound, where they got water, and they ran it through a desalinization plant. And that was run by the engineers. So if you were a second lieutenant, of course, you had to do that officer of the day thing every so often. And I was really reluctant to do that, because you had to go check these guard posts at night. And I always rued the day where I'd find somebody sleeping and have to write them up. Never happened, but I always thought about that. Or somebody not hearing me coming up, you know, I'd try to click them on the radio, let them know I was coming. But we had to go check the Koreans, too, and you had to take a Korean sergeant with you. Of course, I didn't speak Korean, he didn't speak English, but we got through that.
Right.
So that was always interesting, but I only did that a couple of three times. So I lucked out. Don Batun was pretty nice, but I spent a lot of time out with the different units that we supported. And I was, in addition to being the spy officer, I had additional duties like paymaster, which was a horrendous job once a month. I had to fly down to Saigon and pick up the pay for the unit. And they paid in military pay certificates, you know, funny money, I call it. But in any case, we had a large unit with over 200 people, and you had to go down there and draw out the exact dollar amount to pay every one of those paychecks. And you couldn't turn any money back in. So you better have the right amount when you left. So I had to figure out how much money I had to have and in what denominations to pay everybody. And it was a nightmare to do that.
I bet that'd be pretty tough.
It was. And then you signed for it. I signed for it. And it was usually $30,000 of paychecks, funny money. And then I had to break it down for each soldier, wrap it in a rubber band, and wrap his pay slip around it so that when it got time to pay, they would come in and sign for it, and I'd hand them the money. And that was fine, as long as I was at Dom Batin. But we had guys all over the place, so I would have to pay the guys at Dom Batin, and then I'd have to get on a helicopter and go to Bami Tuit to find one guy or two guys who were up there working on something. And then I had to go to Onkay or Fantiet or somewhere, wherever the fellas were working, to pay them off. And I had to do all that within 10 days. So I spent a lot of time tracking people down all over the place to give them their money. And then I'd have to fly back down to Saigon and turn in all the signed receipts. So I dreaded payday, believe me. I would have rather had a root canal than do that.
How many times did you have to do that?
Yeah, but I had to do it. So
how many times were you pay officer?
6 months.
Oh, for 6 full months?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
yeah, that'd be a mess.
Well, yeah, and it was a pain in the neck for everybody because they had to, I wasn't a rated officer, I could fly the helicopter, but I had to have a warrant officer with me who's the commander. And so they'd take, the warrant officers were test pilots, and I'd have to take one of them with to escort me all over the country along with my, I had to have a guard, armed guard with me whenever I had this money. So it was cumbersome to say the least. But they finally had another lieutenant come in, and I was relieved of that duty, which was good.
Yeah, I would think so.
But I did get to see a lot of Vietnam that way.
I would guess that you did. Tell me what you saw when you're traveling around. You're going, like you said, you're going to Onkay, Bami Tuit, Saigon, all over the place.
Well, my first trip to Saigon was when I went down to Cu Chi, and we flew into Saigon because our group headquarters, 34th Group, was there in Saigon. So at Tan Son Nhut Air Base, you had the fixed wing runways, and you had a little area where the rotary helicopters and all that came in, and that was close to where 34th Group headquarters was. So when we went down there that first time, Major Bowen, we wanted to go in there and shake hands with everybody, how we're doing, and so on and so forth. So I recall distinctly going in there, and as we were walking off from the helicopter down the walkways to the headquarters, I was walking between rows of aluminum caskets stacked over my head. It must have been 12 foot tall, and that was really an eerie feeling. Empty caskets just stacked up there, hundreds of them. I said, man, oh man, oh man. So we went into the headquarters group there, and they had a television, and I'm not sure, it was one of the news, major news channels that was on, and they were broadcasting about the Watts riots. And I said, holy cow, that's going on in America, and I'm over here, I might be better off over here. That was kind of spooky. Another time we flew down to Vung Tau, Army Aviation had a maintenance ship, believe it or not, Corpus Christi Bay, anchored there. And that's where they did maintenance on certain aircraft. Pretty high-tech ship. So that was the first time we ever flew on a helicopter pad on a ship. It was pretty interesting. got to spend a day on there and have lunch with the captain of the ship. There again, they eat quite well with napkins and china and all that. And Bung Tao was a R&R spot for the GIs, believe it or not. It was Port City. And they would go down there, and I guess they'd go to the beach and have a little recreation for a day or two, and then back to the field again. So we would go down there occasionally with some of our guys and drop them off. And usually we flew slicks most of the time, so we had no guns and we had plenty of room. So if somebody needed a ride somewhere that we were headed, we'd pick them up and take them out. And coming back from Saigon, we would pretty much stay along the coast. And we'd stay about 2,500 feet or so. And the bomb craters were clearly visible, where the B-52s had unloaded. I mean, it looked like just pock marks for miles and miles, and you could see where they had put all the defoilant out because all the vegetation was gone, dead as could be. That was always interesting. And you'd go up the coast to Phan Thiet or Phan Rang or wherever, and we'd stop and get fuel. And most of the places where you stop to get fuel, there wasn't much there, but just the dirt fuel pad and a fuel truck. And almost all of them had a track vehicle there with four 50 caliber machine guns mounted on it. So you'd get in and get out as soon as you could. The coast was beautiful. The towns along there were, you could tell the French influence because of the architecture. Beautiful scenery along there. And on the other side, in the mountainside, you had Da Nang and places like that, which were just lovely. Saigon was pretty interesting. We spent some time there. We one of the hotels we stayed in was, of course, a French colonial hotel, and they didn't have any air conditioning. You had that musty old shower and sort of a rumpled up bed to sleep in while you were in Saigon. But we did go to the Intercontinental Hotel. That was quite a trip to go up to the top story. And they had a big bar up there in the restaurant. And that's where all the war correspondents hung out. And of course, the big brass, all that. So we went up there one evening, and we had swimming clothes. All we had was our flight clothes on, but it didn't matter. Went up there and had a drink, and you could look out and you could see all over the place. And about everywhere you look, within a 180 degree arc, was flares going off or some kind of impacting round from somewhere. You could almost see the two lights. Seemed like a lot of stuff going out in the jungle out there. But Saigon was a lively city. It was every bit what you would see in Good Morning America. Very, very much like that.
Yeah.
And you go north of Cameron Bay up the coast, and you have Nha Trang and Phan Thiet, Da Nang, which were coast cities, and China Beach is up there, a little further up. We would go up to Da Nang and do maintenance up there. And the first cab was up in on K and Play Ku, right up in the valley up there. And they were constantly having aircraft shot up. I mean, they were our biggest customer.
Yeah, I bet.
But they were in contact every single day. I mean, those guys, they flew their asses off. I tell you what, I admire those guys. They were in the Hydrang Valley, hot and heavy,
for
4 years easy, just punching it out. So we would go in there, and we would carry and repair parts that they needed. And one of our other missions was to evacuate aircraft. So if they had an aircraft that was down somewhere and needed to be picked up, we would, of coordinate that with the Chinook unit that was down at Dalmatinen. We would arrange to have them go in and pick it up, but they would just pick it up. They wouldn't go in and rig it, so we had to take our guys in to rig the slings.
Right.
To pick them up, and sometimes they weren't the best places to go in to get them out. Always interesting. And when you would leave Da Nang, you would go up the road into Hankai, and that's where all the Transportation Corps guys were getting their butt shot off, because it was just ambush city. The engineers had pushed the jungle back maybe 100 feet on each side of the road, but 100 feet's not it when the guy putting RPGs at you.
Right.
So we would travel up that road. Whenever we went up there, we'd just kind of run up that way, just to have a helicopter in there, maybe kept the PC off those fellas. But it was a busy, busy road going up into that valley. A lot of respect for those guys. And, of course, the Marines were operating out of Da Nang all the time, north of Da Nang mostly. And Da Nang was a crazy place, boy. Busy runway. We flew out of there one day, and we had just gotten, we were 200 or 300 feet off the runway, and underneath us came a Vietnam Air DC-3. I don't know whether he didn't see us or he just decided to take off, but it I had to change my underwear after that.
Oh, man.
It was a scary thing, and same thing in the Trang. They had Air America flew a lot out of the Trang, and they flew to the spook missions. They had Helio couriers, and they had some DC-3s too that they flew. And of course, they were always, I think they were running into Laos. Who knows where they were going? But they were kind of strange to watch, those fellas. So you go up the coast from the Trang, and off in the Trang there were two Navy ships anchored out there, and they were power generating ships to provide power to parts in the Trang. It was kind of interesting. And when you're flying in the Trang, they have a gigantic Buddhist statue up on a hill that you fly around to get into the pattern up there. And the Trang was a pretty city. It wasn't terribly beautiful, but it has some nice areas, and again, French influence on it. Highway 1 was quite a place too. It ran along the coast, and then it went up through there's some mountains above Palm Bitten in the Trang, so it wound through those hills on up to Da Nang. Fog would come in on those hills, and they weren't that high. They may be 2,000 feet at the most, but the fog would come in because of it's so close to the ocean. And we actually had a helicopter crash up there and lost 12 people because they had the pilot, co-pilot, and they had, I think they had 8 or 9, maybe 10 Vietnamese in there, and they were big people, so you carry a whole bunch of them in there. And that was pretty bad. That to happen. Monroe Bay, they call that. So, it's a beautiful country.
And it certainly sounds like you've seen a lot of it there.
Yeah, I did. I was pretty lucky to have that tour. Bammy took one fun because that was right on the Laotian border, and they were usually having some kind of mortar round or something dropped on them there. Sort of like Coochie, which was almost in the middle of the rubber plantations. I never did get down to the Delta, but mostly the Central Highlands. Pretty country.
Mr. McKeever, that probably takes us to a good point to stop for today.
All right.
This is Kelly Crager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Francis McKeever. Today is 8 September 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and by telephone from his home in Charleston, South Carolina. there was something that you wanted to correct in from last session. What was that?
I had I was talking about when we did our runs up to the first cabin on K, and I said we went out of Da Nang. We actually went up from Quinyon, which was where Highway 19 started, and ran up through the valley up into On K and Play Coup. So it wasn't Da Nang, it was Quinyon.
Sure, that would make sense, yeah.
It'll be a much longer run if we were flying out of Da Nang, I can tell you.
Yeah, I'm sure that it would have. Well, today I'd like for you to take me through, you know, a typical day for you. You know, what time do you get up? What is your routine? What sort of things would you be involved with? Take me through a day in Vietnam for you.
In my particular case, we ran our platoon on a 24/7 operation, so we had a day shift and a night shift, and that was required because we had to update all our records at night, whereas during the day we were issuing and receiving parts and things of that nature. So the platoon was split up. I usually got out of bed about 6 o'clock, and I tried to get over to the mess hall and get some chow pretty quick so I could get over to the platoon headquarters and see what was going on, see what kind of requisition volume we had the day before, because I had to report that down to the group, see what we had coming in, and make sure that everybody was allocated to handle the workloads. Once I did that, I went about some of my additional duties, which were numerous as a second lieutenant.
Yeah, sure.
I had the sanitation officer's job, which was pretty nasty for a long time, because we had to, you know, clean all the latrines and burn the waste, which was always a task to do. We fortunately were able to hire local Vietnamese who could do that, and they would come on post about 7:30. Of course, they had to go through all the checkpoints, and then they would go around to the different units that they were working for to do their jobs, and one of them was taking care of that sanitation issue.
How would you screen the Vietnamese to decide whether or not you wanted to hire them?
We worked through the 18th Engineer Brigade, which actually had control of the post. They were the brigade headquarters. So they would have a, I guess you would call it, a civilian personnel office, and they would take our requirements and find people to do that job. They also had the security at our gate, and not on the perimeter. The Koreans had the perimeter. So they would go through the engineer security, and then they'd come over to our unit. And Highway 1 ran right down the center of Dong Bien, so on our side, we had the 18th Engineer Brigade, we had our unit, and we had a Chinook helicopter company there, as well as the control tower for the runway. On the other side, we had a B team from the Special Forces, and we had two assault helicopter companies in the Korean security base. So it was a pretty good sized facility. And I don't know, I guess we probably had 40 or 50 Vietnamese running around the compound, at least in our area, every day. I always wondered in my mind what they saw and what they knew. But they would come in and do that kind of thing. They would do laundry for soldiers. Initially, it started out, they'd have to take it out outside in big pots where it had boiling water and clean it that way, but we were able to secure some washing and dry machines that took a lot of that burden off of the hand washing deal. They were mostly all mama-sans, which were the women. We call them mama-sans. Very few men doing any of that kind of labor. They would come into the officers' quarters, and they would, do our laundry, and they would actually iron any of the fatigues that we wore. We usually wore flight suits, but when we had fatigues, they would iron them for us. They would sweep and clean and things like that with little old straw brooms. It was very interesting to see them cleaning the way they did. But they were, for the most part, good workers, friendly, even though there was usually a language barrier. We always paid them a little extra money in tips because they did work for us. But they would never take any of our food, which was kind of interesting. They didn't care for American food for some reason. So after that, I would take care of the sanitation duties, look at the guard roster to see where we stood in terms of that, go back to the platoon headquarters and work a while on that mission. If I had to go somewhere for pay, I would take care of that during the day, maybe 2 or 3 days if it took me out of the area. I also was on a few court-martial boards, which consumed quite a bit of time as an investigating officer.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? That seems really interesting.
Well, you know, we had being a major as a company commander, so he had, I think it was probably summary court-martial authority, as well as Article 15, which was non-judicial punishment. So, you know, if we had discipline problems or soldiers got into fights or did something crazy, you know, they could face court-martial. And then if it went to a higher authority, it would come out of Natrang, where the 14th Trans-Battalion Headquarters maintained the General Court-Martial Board, and they would select officers to sit on that board at random. And so if they had a general court martial, you would have to go in the train and sit on that board up there. We had one soldier who, and this was probably, October time frame, who went a little crazy and got a hold of a .45 caliber pistol and went into the commander's office and pointed a gun at him and said, "I'm going home." And that was a pretty nervous situation. Major Bowden finally got him calmed down, and we got the pistol away from him and got him arrested, and he ended up going to Long Binh prison down in Saigon. So he didn't go home. He went somewhere else.
Yeah.
But he just, I don't know, he was an aircraft mechanic, and I guess the stress was something he couldn't deal with. So that was an unfortunate situation. During the day, if someone was going to do a test flight and I had some time, I always rode along because I always like to get in the air with some of these old warrant officers, because they could almost fly one upside down. Not quite, but they had a lot of fun test flying different aircraft. And the afternoon went by pretty quick. We tried to get all requisitions out. We always had somebody going out to the units that we supported with parts, or the units were coming in to get parts. Sometimes during the day, we would have to go out and rig a helicopter for lift back to Dongbatan if it was unflyable. We always had a crew that did that. They were pretty good at it.
Would you mind taking me through that process? If you have a downed Huey somewhere, what would be the protocol? How would this whole system work?
Well, of course, we would know it was down, obviously. Then we would, if it was in our area of responsibility, we would set up time to go out and put the rigging on, which meant we would put the slings on it so that the Chinooks could come in and get it. If the Chinooks weren't available, we had to get it rigged, and we would go ahead and get it rigged and go back the next day and wait on the Chinooks to come in and pick it up. It wasn't always fun, because sometimes it wasn't a good place to get at them. All we had were slicks. We didn't have organic weapons on our aircraft, so whatever we went out with was what we could carry, our, you know, our own AKs, I mean, our own MR rifles or machine guns. So we tried to get in and get out, and depending on how badly the aircraft was, dictated how much time it took to get it rigged. We tried to rig it on the, what they call the Jesus nut, which is up on a rotor, so you get a quick hookup on it and pick it out of there. If they were really, really messed up, we would just destroy them with the thermite, get the tail number, and get rid of it.
Yeah.
So we didn't have to try to repair something. There was nothing on it worth recovering.
Yeah. Yeah, I assume strip the radios and weapons and things like that.
It would take care of anything like that, but usually it was totally destroyed. Most of the time they were in areas that, you know, weren't well-traveled, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to do it. I went on a few of them, and we got in and got out. Had no problems, but I wouldn't want to make a career doing that.
Yeah, especially if it were an aircraft downed by enemy fire, which would mean that, you know, the enemy could still very well be pretty close to the area.
Well, that's true, and you never knew
when
you were out there what you would see.
Did you ever have to call in, say, gunships for support or anything?
Well, there was usually some type of support in the air all the time, and you would just, we had two helicopters come across the street from us that would be available if we needed them to go out with us, depending on where it was. A lot of times somebody else would be able to go in and get it before we could. We had we had sky crane helicopters, which were these big looked like a praying mantis, almost huge thing that could lift a much larger load, and they would every once in a while bring in one that was banged up pretty bad, rather than the Chinooks. Quite interesting to see them.
Yeah. Yeah.
We usually had somebody run down to Cameron Bay with a deuce and a half to pick up any spare parts that were flown in from either Bell Helicopter or AFCO by the Air Force. One of our missions was to receive new helicopters into the country for distribution in the two core area, and they would come out of Corpus Christi, Texas, loaded into C-141s with the tail booms taken off and turned sideways against the aircraft, and we would get four to six of them at a time off of the 141s. So we would have to take a crew down to Cameron. We'd fly them down there, and they would reassemble the helicopters and fly them back up to Don Batin, which was just a 10-minute flight at the very most. And then we would pre-fly and test fly them and then issue them out to the units. And that really kept us pretty busy in that regard. At one time, during the buildup, which was taking place in 67 and 68, we were receiving three or four plane loads a week, and we were really running out of space to put all these helicopters. As a matter of fact, during Tet, we had, I think we probably had 25 or 30 new helicopters across the street on the pad over there that the assault helicopter companies used because they had the space. And on the night the Tet began, the Viet Cong got in there and blew up, I think they got maybe eight or nine helicopters with explosive devices that they had made. What they did was they had big old rocks, stones, big enough a man could carry it, but they hollowed the things out and put black powder in there and made those into an explosive, almost like a satchel charge, but it was a big stone. So then when it blew up, it threw stone fragments all over. You there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
I don't know what that was. The battery's not going bad. So we lost a few helicopters that way during this particular event, which was really interesting. That pretty much took care of a day for me.
Yeah.
Get done with the day and go back to the officers' quarters, get a little bite to eat, have a couple of beers, and write letters. Try to read my mail.
And was this a daily occurrence that you wrote letters home?
I wrote a letter home almost every day as a sidelight. My wife kept all those letters. I couldn't keep hers. We had to destroy mail from the States. Hmm. She kept all those letters. And a year ago, I got all those letters out and I went through them and I wrote a book about my tour over there based on the letters, and related things that I was unable to tell her about in the letters, didn't want to tell her about.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting thing.
Yeah, I bet that must have been quite a process to go back through that again.
It took almost a year to do it.
Yeah.
And I recently found some more letters, so I'm going to do an addendum to the book.
Oh, that's great.
But things that we enjoyed, we're not far from Cameron, so whenever the USO people came in, we tried to get our guys down there to see Bob Hope or whoever was coming through. General Westmoreland would come there. We didn't get too many VIPs where we were.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Donut Dollies and the Red Cross girls. They were around.
What did you think about the Donut Dolly, Red Cross girls?
I thought they were really real nice folks. I mean, they worked real hard. They were in an all-male environment. It was probably a little unusual for them, but they were real helpful. They cared about soldiers. One of my roommates actually ended up marrying one after his tour.
I'll be darned.
So we enjoyed them having them around. I had I'd come down with hepatitis on Thanksgiving Day of 67 and was evacuated to the 6th Convalescent Center in Cameron, and they had all the malaria patients, the hepatitis folks, and people who had wounds that weren't serious enough to have them medevac to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the recuperation and rehabilitation center for quite a large part of Vietnam. And that's where they had all the course of Army nurses and physicians. So I spent from Thanksgiving Day through January, well, through New Year's Eve there.
Wow.
It was a long time.
I
was really sick.
Yeah, what was the type of treatment, the quality of treatment you had? And this is
well,
a very long time to be holed up like this.
The hepatitis A is caused by ingesting feces. And I tried to figure out where I'd been, that I'd gotten some fruit or something that could have been contaminated, or you never know. I mean, I'd been up in Bammy Tuit for a while, and that was not a great place. And I think I probably got the virus there.
Mm-hmm.
And it incubated for a while. And then on Thanksgiving Day, one of the warrant officers, I got up in the morning. We had a low work level that day. And he looked at my eyes and he said, "Boy, your eyes are yellow." He said, "You got some problems here. You have hepatitis." So he said, "We're going to..." And I was sick. I didn't want to go eat Thanksgiving meal, which is a big, big thing.
Yeah.
So we went to the aid station. He says, yeah, we believe you've got the bug. Of course, they got you out of there as quick as they could because they didn't want you contaminating anybody else.
Sure.
So over we went. They had a ward. We actually had two buildings that had malaria and hepatitis patients together. And they were air-conditioned, thank goodness, but they were just lined with sick people. And I, being an officer, had a, as you walked in, they had two rooms for officers, so I shared a room with a lieutenant who had malaria from the Big Red One. And I was just sick as a dog for probably 3 weeks, no appetite, just really sick. And what they did was they gave you gamma goblin injections, and hepatitis just bed rest, and eventually you'll overcome it.
Yeah. I've heard horror stories about these shots.
They hurt, I can tell you that. It's a big old needle. And of course they drew blood from it almost every day to check the blood count, find out what your status was.
Yeah.
So I was in there from Thanksgiving to New Year's Eve, and my roommate was from the Red One. He was an infantry officer. He was an Italian kid. And I had, he had actually come over Vietnam on the Geiger, the same ship I came over on. I didn't realize it. But in any case, he was Italian from New York, and it was coming on to Christmas time, and they were bringing in care packages. Your mail would run behind because you were over there, and they'd have to get your mail to you. And one day this bang crushed up carton came in the mail, and it was all stained and kind of smelly. And he opened it up, and his grandmother had mailed him a lasagna through the APO system, which was probably in the mail for 3 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
It was not a really nice gift. We kind of laughed about it. We had no appetites for that anyway.
Right.
But I received mail from school kids all over the country who just mailed to a soldier who was in the hospital. And I enjoyed reading those letters. My roommate from the Citadel was in divinity school, and he had all his Sunday school kids write letters to me. So it was helpful to have that kind of treatment in the hospital.
Yeah.
And while I was in there, they had a rolling library they'd bring around on a little cart, and had all different kinds of books. And I got a chance to get a hold of Bernard Fall's book about
is that right?
Huh. Yeah, Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I read that book, and I was really startled to see the very close comparison to what was going on at our time. You know, Street Without Joy was follow the French, and what tactics led to their defeat in D&B and Phu. And, you know, the U.S. was doing a lot of things just like the French. I mean, we'd hold some land and give it up, go back and get it, give it up. But we were never able to truly overcome the hearts and minds of a lot of the people.
Yeah.
Christmas was kind of interesting. We had a little church there, so they had a midnight mass, and there was a ceasefire at midnight, which was supposed to last for, I don't know, an hour or so, but it probably didn't last 20 minutes. I don't know. The Koreans had an artillery battery up above the hospital there, and quarter after midnight, they were firing away. So, wasn't much of a ceasefire. We had, it was right on the China Sea there, beautiful beach. So, I guess mid-December, I was feeling a lot better, and I was able to walk around and get out and get some muscle tone back after being laid up in that bed for such a long time.
Yeah, I would think that would be a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, it was just boredom, to tell you the truth. You can only read so much, and they don't, you know, they didn't have a workout room or anything of that nature for us to use, so. If you wanted to get some exercise, you had to do it yourself. But in any case, got through Christmas there and left on New Year's Eve back to the unit. Of course, they were having a great New Year's Eve party, but I couldn't partake because you weren't allowed to have any alcohol for quite a while, at least until your liver got back to normal.
Yeah, that's about the last thing in the world you needed.
Yeah. So I got back to the unit on New Year's Eve, and I was the designated driver and bartender. But it was all in good fun.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, we're cooking along. We were getting a lot of intel about Tet and what the potentials were, so it was no surprise that there were attacks on Tet, at least not to us.
Could you tell me about the intel that you were receiving? A lot of units, a lot of folks say, well, we had nothing, it was a complete total surprise. Others say, no, this was something that we had some intel on, and you're obviously calling
you
this game.
The Koreans had some intelligence, and of course the group and others had intel, but saying that to be prepared, that they were, it was the holiday, and there was no telling what kind of attacks there would be or how large they were, but to be vigilant. So we paid attention to that. We had scrounged some heavy corrugated PSP material from the Air Force, and we had been able to put that all around our computer van so that if any kind of mortar attack took place, it had to land right on top of us to do any damage. So we had hardened that as best we could. We had, by February of 68, the engineers had put a power plant in so that our equipment could operate off of much, much larger generator. We didn't have to run our 15 kW all day and all night. And that was a hardened shelter. We made sure that our command bunker and the bunkers for the troops, each barracks had a bunker of their own where they could go if there was an attack. So, you know, they were briefed. Since we were 24/7, of course, we had people working all the time, and it's hard to have light discipline when you're trying to run a maintenance hangar and a supply function. So that was probably not a good thing, but we just had to maintain our operations. And we felt pretty good that the Koreans on the perimeter would do their job. Unfortunately, they somehow failed to catch these guys coming in across Highway 1 to where our helicopters were, and we lost those helicopters, and we took some mortar fire around the perimeter, but the Viet Cong came in and left, and we didn't catch any of them.
I wonder if
Cameron took some rocket fires into a fuel point over there and did some damage. But we didn't have any massive invasion of the of the compound or anything like that.
Yeah.
We lost our water point, got hit with, we think it was a mortar. So that was a bit of a problem. Biggest problem we had as a unit was that all of our supported units out in the two-core area were under attack, too. So we had helicopters that were damaged in the field. And in Saigon, at our group headquarters, their workload all of a sudden went through the roof because they had to support all of the helicopters in Vietnam.
Right.
So they came and levied some of my guys to go to Saigon to help take care of that workload. So we flew them out the next day right into that mess down there. I think we sent about eight guys to work down there.
What is the workload like for your group up there?
We were really, really busy. We got behind, so we started issuing a lot of stuff on paper because we couldn't keep up with the backlog because we lost some people who had gone to Saigon, and we had other people who had to attend to the supported units in the field. But we were real busy for, I guess, 6 weeks after Tet. And during all this time from, I guess from October, we had started integrating new soldiers into our unit and sending some of our soldiers to other units so that when the time came to rotate, the whole unit didn't rotate at the same time. So we were filtering people in and out through that 5-6 month period, including officers. So we had a number of officers who were with either direct support helicopter companies or maintenance companies, all the way up to Da Nang, who had been with us. And they were all scrounging for parts wherever they could get them. So they would call me and ask me if I had this particular item, and if I had it, I would tell them, yeah, and they would fly down and get it. They needed it so bad because they had so many combat missions going on up in one corps and in two corps that they had to keep their helicopters in the air.
Right.
So we were pretty busy issuing anything we could to make sure they could keep them up.
Y'all were already 24/7 kind of outfit, like you mentioned before.
Yeah, but it was a much heavier volume. Like I say, it was so heavy that our computer people couldn't input the data into the system. That's how fast we were issuing stuff, so we would just issue it on paper and then back it up into the system as we could. And that lasted for about 6 weeks.
And you mentioned that where you were there, Don Pretend, wasn't hit too hard. Yeah,
oh,
you
no.
Had some come in.
We had the sappers come in that night, and that was about it.
Yeah.
But some of the other, the train got hit pretty good. Our headquarters, the 14th Trans Battalion, was there, and they took a lot of mortar fire right onto the air base up there. And it was a big air base. So they took some pretty heavy damage too. They actually had some injuries. But
we
got through Tet, and then we started to prepare for the return home. A little early, but that's what everybody was thinking. I was able to get an R&R trip in with one of the other officers to Bangkok.
Tell me about that.
Well, we had to bum a ride down to Saigon to catch the flight over there, which was kind of strange. But nevertheless, we flew out of Saigon to Bangkok, and we had 7 days, but two of them were tied up traveling. And we flew into Bangkok and stayed at a pretty nice hotel from what we were anticipating, and got to see a lot of the city. It was a crazy, hectic place. I thought that the people in Saigon drove like madmen, but Thailand had them beat, I think. A gigantic city with a river running through it. It was really pretty nasty, to tell you the truth. But some interesting sights they had. They had a zoo there which had these gigantic pythons that would eat whole hogs. They had a gigantic temple with a gold Buddha in it, which I thought was really interesting to see. Of course, modern city in the sense it had skyscrapers and things of that nature. So we did the tourist thing and shopped for things for our fiancés and wives, stuff that they probably would never use, but we had no idea that was the case. And just kind of drank and ate for 5 days and relaxed, and then got back on the plane and headed back. Really, when you, in retrospect, it's kind of crazy to pull somebody out of a war and send them back in. Didn't bother us too bad, but I can just imagine a guy from an infantry unit going on R&R and then knowing he's going to have to go right back to the field and be on a fire base somewhere or whatever, how that would play tricks in your mind.
Yeah, and I hear that quite a bit from a lot
of
folks.
Yeah, I'm sure that they suffered from that. I'm not too sure that the benefits at R&R were worth it. I don't know. It's hard to say. But in any case, we did that. And it was worthwhile to see Thailand. Not sure I'd go back there, but that got us through into March. Then we started receiving more new folks in to make sure that we were able to sustain the mission once we left. And I'm not too sure what the what the dynamics were of how they assigned these people, but for some reason I ended up with a major being assigned. It came to the unit, but they didn't have an assignment for it because the major that was in the slot wasn't ready to leave. So lo and behold, they put him down in charge of my platoon for a temporary period of time. And I had just been promoted to first lieutenant, but I was not real happy to have this aviator major come in and tell me how to run my computers.
I would imagine that the major wasn't all that happy to come in and take over a job from
and he didn't. My personal opinion was his personality and mine weren't on the same wavelength. But he was only there for, I don't know, not even 45 days. He wasn't there long enough to do an OER on me, thank goodness.
So you guys really didn't see eye to eye then, it sounds like.
No, we didn't.
Yeah.
But see, he just wanted to willy-nilly give stuff away, and you can't do that. I mean, he had a lot. He was a master aviator, and he'd been in the aviation for a long time, so he knew everybody in Transportation Corps Aviation, and if somebody needed something, he'd be more than happy to give it to him. Well, it doesn't work that way.
They're not
our
anyway.
Units, and they have to have a legitimate requirement for it, and they have to, in theory and practice, put in the requisitions. So we butted heads quite a number of times in that regard, but we got through it. And during that time, since I got promoted, I was relieved of some of my additional duties, thank goodness, and was able to start writing resumes looking for a job because I wasn't too sure I wanted to continue my career in the Army.
Now yours was
we had technical representatives who were civilians from Bell Helicopter, from Avco, Collins Radio, and they were actually civilians with our unit who did tech rep help for us. So if we had technical problems, they would be able to assist us resolve them. And one of the fellows there was from Avco who built our engines. As it turned out, Avco was building a helicopter engine rebuild plant in Charleston. And when I heard about it, I talked to Hope Freeman was his name and asked him if he could help me find a job there when I rotated back to the States. And of course, he was more than happy to do that. So as it turned out, I pretty much had a job lined up before I left Vietnam. Did in fact go to work for Avco for a few years until the war wound down, and they closed the plant.
Well, your unit was one that came over basically as a whole, coming over on the Geiger.
That's correct.
And this is, you know, not
but
always the way that you think of the Vietnam War. You think of the single individual one-year rotation kind of thing. Tell me how it worked for the entire unit. I mean, is the entire unit getting ready to rotate back to the States? And if so, how do you arrange that? What are the dynamics of that?
Well, what, as I said, we had been receiving new people into the unit from December of 67, so that we would bring a new person in and they would fill a slot, and the person who was in that slot would go to another unit, so that they would rotate out of another unit and we would have a fresh body who had at least 6 months of a tour left. So that we tried to, I'm not quite sure what the number was we were aiming for. I think it was around 50% of the unit would rotate out during that last month of the 12-month tour. And the other 50% would have been brought in over a period of 6 months, so that there was continuity in command and control of the unit. It wasn't like all 200 and some of us left at one time.
Right.
And that was handled by the adjutant. I didn't have much to do with that. I did, when I did rotate, my replacement had not shown up. We had gotten the staff sergeant in to replace Sergeant Copeland, but mine hadn't shown up. He came a month later. But we had pretty much all the officers lined up, and actually had a change of command about 3 weeks before Colonel Ballenbein had been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and I left. But the unit was still able to function quite well, so I didn't have any concerns about it.
Right. Well, let me ask you a few questions before we bring you back home.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of just general questions that I typically ask folks. You mentioned that you had Vietnamese who were working there on the base with you.
Mm-hmm.
What were your views of the Vietnamese in general, whether it was the civilian population, the enemy that you that you encountered to a limited degree, I guess, or, you know, the Vietnamese allies of the United States? What was your opinion on these various
things? Well, a couple things are interesting there. We had the North Koreans who did our perimeter. We also supported one of their aviation units up in the middle of Central Highlands. So we got to know them, and they actually gave the unit one of their Korean military awards before we left. We also supported the Australians who were over with the Special Forces B team, but they had their own aircraft, fixed-wing aircraft. The Vietnamese that I met in the area, in our AO, were, to me, nice people. I didn't come eyeball to eyeball with any Viet Cong. They may have been Viet Cong for all I know, but they were nice people. And I always felt that way about them, that they weren't interested in this war. That all they wanted to do was harvest their little patty of rice and to be left alone by us and by anybody else. I just had that feeling that was the case. And, you know, Vietnam had been fought over for centuries, so they're not unaccustomed to war misery, but I always thought that they were good, decent people, the ones that I knew. It was just a political nightmare that, you know, ended up being resolved in 72, I guess. But now, Vietnam is a big, prosperous country. And even though they have the communist economic model, it's pretty much a free market society over there, and they love Americans. My wife was there 2 years ago, as I said before, and she told them that I had been over there during the war, and most of the folks there said that war's over a long time ago. It's not our war now. We're moving on. So they pretty much have the right idea.
Yeah.
And
what about the Vietnamese military that you encountered? South
Vietnamese? I didn't run into too many of them. They, I don't know who supported aviation assets, but we sure didn't run into them too much. I thought that some of their pilots were a little crazy. As I mentioned at one time, flying out of Quy Nhon, I think it was, where that DC-3 came right up under us, and, you know, they were just kind of sky jockeys, at least the ones that I saw. But never had much to do with their ground elements. We would ferry some of them around, but I never saw them in action.
Well, let me ask you about the Koreans. You mentioned them on a number of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to have very distinct memories of the Koreans. What are your memories of them?
They were pretty hard-nosed soldiers. They were, from what I saw, the senior NCOs ran the unit, not the officers. And I saw a formation one day, and it wasn't long after TEP, so they were really agitated and humbled by the fact that we'd lost some helicopters through their perimeter. And I saw the first sergeant just whack the devil out of one of those enlisted folks with a stick over something. I'm not sure what he did, but they were not immune to physically hitting a soldier for stepping out of line, so they maintained some pretty strong discipline. And from what I heard, I don't believe that that the Viet Cong wanted to mess with them too much. So they were pretty hard-nosed soldiers, from what I know. The one thing that happened not too long before I was getting ready to leave was the Special Forces B team. They were always wanting to trade stuff with us. They wanted to trade AK-47s for whatever we could give them. And one of them had a chrome, solid chrome AK that they wanted to trade with us or something. And I said, well, I'd like to have that weapon, but I'm having a hard time getting it in country once I had it.
Right.
But those guys were always out doing something crazy. And one morning, this is about a month before I leave, when we got to that month before we rotated, they would not let us fly anymore.
Okay.
They said, you can do whatever you want, but you're not going to go flying. So I was spent a lot of time reading and around the huge pain. I was sleeping late one day, and all of a sudden I felt this thing in my bunk crawling all over me, and I said, what in the heck is this on me? And I heard all this laughing and hooting and hollering out in the hallway, and one of the warrant officers had gone over to the B compound and gotten they had a little tiger cub over there, about 4 months old, and and brought this thing back and put it in my bed. And I wake up and here's a little tiger cub crawling all over me. Cutest little thing, swatting at me. I never knew what happened to that cub, but I have a little movie of him. I guess they let him loose.
That's
really tiger cub and pink elephants, that's what I remember.
And pink elephants.
Yeah. The elephants rolled in the clay, in the dust.
Mm, okay.
And it made them pink.
Yeah.
It was kind of amazing to see them, too. Big old things.
You know, another question that kind of comes to mind, given that you were an officer, second lieutenant, later on first lieutenant, is what sort of challenges did you face in terms of leadership? You know, you got a very, very active platoon here, 24/7, as you mentioned before. But what sort of things did you face as the biggest challenges, and how did you deal with them?
I tell you, I was really fortunate to have Sergeant Copeland as my platoon sergeant, because he had an innate ability to get these guys from different walks of life, different demographics, different educations, and different religions, as a matter of fact, to work together. I mean, we had some times where, you know, I was actually doing some of the physical work, going out and pulling parts because we were so shorthanded. And I didn't mind doing that. I felt that was, I wasn't trying to set an example, it was just I felt like I could help out, and I did it. And I'm sure that they appreciated that. The warrant officers taught me a lot, and Colonel Bowden taught me a lot about dealing with people. He would bring me in his office and talk about how things were going with the platoon, what I needed, anything that he could do to help me out. He walked me through quite a few of these court-martial situations because I was all new to that. And it's one thing to be an investigating officer, and it's a whole other thing to be sitting on a board. So it's two separate functions there. I learned a lot from our first sergeant, who was a big old, tall, skinny green bean from Kentucky. And you always think first sergeant, he's just going to bust everybody's balls and make them work 18 hours a day. But he was a good leader. He delegated properly, and then he followed up and he expected results, but he didn't go around shouting and berating people. So in our case, we were, I think our unit was so much different from a line infantry unit or any combat arm unit or even a transportation truck company, by the way we were set up. We didn't lead by committee, everybody had their tasks and they did them, and if you fell down, you heard about it real quick, because we were sort of like a retail operation for aviation. There was guys' aircraft were down and couldn't get the parts, and they didn't mind calling down to group headquarters and say, hey, they don't have the parts up there, help us out. Well, you get a few of those calls down there, they're going to say, well, why don't you have the parts? Why haven't you requisitioned them or backfilled them or what's going on? So it was an interesting assignment in that respect, and sort of like running a little business almost. I was real fortunate to pull that assignment.
Yeah. Were there any morale or discipline problems within the unit?
Not very many. We had the one soldier who had an incident with the commander. But for the most part, it was not a lot of competition among soldiers. Everybody was, number one, they were technical people, so each one of them had a skill other than just being a rifleman or something of that type. So they had gone to school to fix radios or to repair engines or to do airframe work, and it was like running a company. We had production control, quality control, avionics tests, and then the supply function. they all sort of worked as a little business to maintain these aircraft, and it was almost like a fixed base operation today, where you have private airplanes coming in and they need service, and that's what we did. So we didn't have a lot of griping. We always had great food, which was important. We had an excellent mess hall. We were able to get things outside of the supply system, like steaks, for instance, and fresh vegetables. If you were in a combat unit, if you saw a steak, you know, it fell out of the sky. They didn't eat that way.
Right.
So we didn't have a lot of people moping around. And, of course, we weren't getting shot out every day.
Sure.
It makes a tremendous difference in your mindset.
Absolutely. As you were preparing to leave here, to leave Vietnam, do you have the opportunity to stop and think about what you've seen over the previous year, the way the war has been prosecuted? The Tet Offensive obviously is a big part of what you saw. It had a massive impact on not just the war, but on public opinion. What are your thoughts on the way you saw the war being prosecuted for that one?
I thought we were winning the war, and it's hard to define what winning meant. But, you know, Tet was not necessarily a victory for the Viet Cong or the Vietnamese NVA. They lost a lot of casualties. Now, we weren't privy to a lot of the public opinion swings in the States because we didn't have a lot of access to that news. I mean, I didn't know anything about Kent State, for instance, until I got home. But all we were hearing was good stuff from General Westmoreland, and LBJ flew into Cameron Bay and gave a big speech about how great things were going. So from what we knew, we thought that we had the upper hand. And I guess we did it at one point, but I certainly didn't realize that the war was being prosecuted by politicians, where, you know, the rules of engagement kept us out of Laos. So the Ho Chi Minh Trail was not, it was like a superhighway, you know, interstate. That kind of stuff you find out after the fact. So you begin to wonder what would have happened if we'd had other ways of going about business over there. In retrospect, I think it was well-intentioned but misguided in many senses to have that many casualties and that much treasure lost without a goal. And, you know, I saw it again on active duty in Desert Storm, and again on active duty during the Second Gulf War, so history repeats itself.
All right, so you've got everything squared away. You've got your paperwork in order. You know that you're going home. Take me through that that day.
Well, as I said, about a month before we were to leave, Colonel Biden said, "You guys that came over on the first boat, and stand down. Be available if your replacements need you, but I want you to go to the beach. Do whatever you want. Just stay out of trouble." So, over in Cameron, on the ocean side, there was a really nice, sort of a R&R area. It was just a white sandy beach with gigantic coral formations as big as buildings, just huge, and had a little tiki bar there where you can get a beer or something. So just three or four of us would get in a Jeep and go over there and spend a day over there, getting all burned up in the sun and drinking beer and writing letters. They had beautiful blue water over there. I can never forget how nice the water was. And they had these sea turtles that would come out of the ocean, and they were, I don't know, they were 4 or 5 feet around in diameter. You could actually stand on it. It would just walk away with you standing on it. So I enjoyed doing that. You do little snorkeling out there. So we spent the last couple weeks doing that. And then the remainder of the unit started going out a couple every day. And I was still waiting on my orders, and Colonel Bond called me and said, "Listen, you're going to be the last one to go with me." He says, I just got to have you here until we go. So I said, "Well, that's fine. I mean, I knew I was going to leave on the right day, so I didn't care about it too much."
Yeah.
And sure enough, we got all packed up. We had to pack all our belongings in these big old cardboard boxes because you just couldn't carry all the stuff you accumulated home with you. So we had done that about 2 weeks before, or 3 weeks before, and they sent a big old truck out. I think it was United Van Lines actually had the contract to do that. And they picked all this stuff up, all our clothes and stuff that we accumulated in this big old box, and took it down to Cameron, put it on a ship, and sent it home. So all we had were enough clothes to last us for the time we were there. And so we packed up that day, and we had to, put on our khakis to get on the airplane, if I recall. And went down to Cameron, got on a 707. I remember it distinctly because it was a much nicer airplane than I had flown out of Fort Bragg on. Got on there, and that thing was jam-packed. He closed up the door, and he took off, and he went off the runway 40 feet, and everybody was cheering, hollering, hooping, screaming. And the stewardess came by and was giving out beer. And off we went. Stopped in Tokyo to refuel. It was dark, so we didn't see much. Didn't even get off the airplane. Left Tokyo and flew right into Oakland to debark. Got off at Oakland, and they had the Transportation Corps had an office there, which was responsible to get everybody going in the right direction. And of course, these were all individuals going back, so they were all going to different places. And it took a while to go through that process, and Colonel Bowden and I ended up having to catch a C-130 flight down to Los Angeles in order to get back east. So that took a day, and then we got a late flight out of Los Angeles into Chicago. And in Los Angeles, it was kind of eerie because people kind of looked at you like you had leprosy or something. I don't know. It was an eerie feeling because, we didn't expect a brass band, but I kind of sensed that, you're just a soldier coming back from a place that we weren't interested in.
Yeah.
And I had the same feeling in Chicago, and Colonel Bowden and I separated there, and I went on to Pittsburgh where my folks lived, and then he went to Texas where he was living. But we didn't have anybody spitting on us, but we didn't have anybody coming up and shaking our hands either.
Anybody say anything to you?
No, I don't think anybody struck up any kind of conversations, even on the airplane. When we got to Chicago, we changed into civilian clothes. We decided that we were not in the appropriate dress. So I got into Pittsburgh and I'd lost quite a bit of weight, so I probably look like a homeless person. I lost almost 30 pounds while I was sick with hepatitis. So that was kind of unusual to have that feeling, and it was, I guess, a homecoming of sorts. I don't know. Totally different from coming back from Desert Storm.
Now, who met you there in Pittsburgh?
My parents met me, and my brother wasn't there because he was at Fort Sill getting ready to redeploy back.
Well, he was going back to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was just a flip-flop, and that's kind of when I really made up my mind that, you know, this was not the thing I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I guess, and my fiance said she didn't want me going back over there either, and I had no guarantees that I would go back in the same capacity, and I sure didn't want to go back as a truck company commander. So I came off of active duty in November, and
68.
That's correct.
Okay.
And went to work for Avco in Charleston. Went down and had an interview, and they hired me. And as a material control analyst. So we were actually, I was actually doing the same thing I was doing in Vietnam. They were rebuilding engines over there, and we had a supply function to make sure we had all the parts necessary to get the production of that engine back online. So I actually saw parts with tags on it that had come back from Vietnam, where I had to send them back to the States because we didn't need them anymore.
Is that right?
For my unit.
Isn't that something?
Eerie feeling.
Yeah. Now, you're back to a civilian life in November of 68. There's still an awful lot of war left. Do you continue to follow the war at all?
Well, I had a six-year obligation from the day I was commissioned, which was in 66. So I joined the South Carolina National Guard, which I thought would be a good thing, but it turned out not to be a good thing, because they had some transportation units in the reserves in Charleston, but they were all full. There was no vacancies, and the National Guard had a few vacancies. So naively, I said, well, I'll just go in there and see, you know, maintain my affiliation with the military. Well, the National Guard is not like the regular Army or the Reserves, which I learned pretty early on, and it was a mechanized infantry unit, and they were made up of mostly local folks who didn't want to go to Vietnam, who were able to find slots in National Guard, which would exempt them from going to Vietnam.
What did you think about that?
I just thought it was kind of bad, to be honest with you, but I had signed off for a year, so I had to do my year, which I did, and then I got out of the National Guard and finished my 3 years. So in 1972, I resigned my commission. In 1982, I was recommissioned. I had the opportunity to go into a transportation unit.
Why the change 10 years later? Why the decision to go back?
One of my Vietnam friends, who was a O-1 pilot, was in the unit. And my career at that time, I had gone from Avco when they closed down into the shipping business in Charleston. And he knew my background was in shipping. And the Transportation Corps unit was a terminal unit, so they ran ocean terminals for the military. So he knew that I had that background, and he said, would you come into the unit? And I thought about it, and I said, yeah, I'll do that, because I had kids in private school. I felt like it would be a good assignment, and it would be extra income for their tuition. So I went back in as a captain, and I served in that unit from 1982 all the way through the first Gulf War as a major, and then came back. I spent a year on active duty on the first Gulf War, and came back into the unit as a reservist through 98, when I was promoted to lieutenant colonel. I had to go into the individual augmentee program because they didn't have a slot for me, so I went into that, and then I worked for the MCMIC headquarters. And in 2001, I got called back to active duty for 5 years after 9/11, and finally retired in 2004. So I had a nice career, a lot of interesting people to work for me, and I worked for a lot of interesting people.
Wonderful.
I worked for the first female four-star general in the Army.
Oh, is that right?
General Dunwoody, Ann Dunwoody. And she was a one-star. Smart lady.
I wonder if you might take me through your experiences. It doesn't have to be as in-depth as we did with Vietnam, but tell me a little bit about your experiences in Desert Storm, how it came about, where you were stationed, what your activities were, as well as the Second Gulf War, and just throw a little comparison contrast in there with me. With Vietnam.
As I said, I was in a reserve unit that operated ocean terminals. So in the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait City, President Bush reacted, and of course he started sending units over there. And one of the ports that we supported was Wilmington, North Carolina. So our responsibility was to deploy the 82nd Airborne Division to get them out and get them over there as quick as we could. So 2 days after he went into Kuwait, we were activated to go to Wilmington to deploy the division, and we were up there for just about 60 days. We got them out, and we came off of active duty. And then in January of 91, the buildup was really big over there, and the port of Daman was gigantic. So the Transportation Corps said we needed units over there to be prepared to retrograde when this war's over. Well, we didn't know how long that would be, but in any case, it wasn't very long. And in June of 91, our unit was put on active duty again to go to the Gulf and run part of the port of Daman. There were only three reserve units put on active duty to do that. So our unit went over there, and we did all the retrograde of cargo, equipment, and ammunition from June through December. That was hard work over there. It was a very, very hot climate, of course. All the oil wells were still burning. We had no labor. The Saudis don't do manual labor. They hire people from Bangladesh and from other third world countries to be their labor. So we had to deal with that problem. The port was just overrun with thousands and thousands of pieces of equipment going back to the States, both our equipment as well as captured Iraqi equipment all over the place. It was unbelievable. And we again worked 24/7 because we got ships coming in every other day just to be loaded up. We lived on these big barges that were like floating hotels that the oil industry used when they were drilling for oil over there. That's where they kept oil well workers on these big buildings. They were four stories high. and they had two-man rooms with little bathrooms. So we lived there, and we ate in a big contract mess hall. It was quite a bit different from Vietnam in that sense. When I was there, I had my father passed away in July, so I flew home, and I had to fly back to Pittsburgh. And when I came home, I flew on a space available on a KC-10 tanker back to Andrews in Washington, D.C., and then went through the SATO office there to get a trip commercial back to Pittsburgh. And so I flew out of Reagan Airport, and I had my desert uniform on, and I had people shaking my hands. People wanted to buy me dinner. Totally different feeling than Vietnam. It was kind of amazing. So I came home, and then I went back. When I got back, the Chief of Naval Operations had gotten some information that the Egyptian Army was taking the equipment out of the country that didn't belong to them. But he had information, he didn't have any proof. So he called our headquarters, and General Pagonis was in charge of all the logistics then. Wanted to know if they had somebody who knew anything about port operations that could go up into Kuwait and find out what is actually going on with the Egyptians. So I was given that assignment to go into Kuwait with the military intelligence people to investigate the Egyptian logistics trail. The military intelligence guys lived in Kuwait City, and they had confiscated a big 10-story marble building that the Kuwaitis kept their concubines in to live in. So that was where we worked out of, and we went all over Kuwait looking for stuff that the Egyptians were taking. All well fires were still going. It was really interesting to see.
Must have been quite a scene.
See the destruction. Oh yeah, it was amazing to see that. The highway of hell was unbelievable. Just like a mile and a half long junkyard, just littered with blown up, destroyed equipment. Iraqi tanks all over the desert. You couldn't get out of your vehicle because you step on some live ammunition that might have been laying out there. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, some people did get hurt. Treasure hunting out there. In any case, I spent a week or two with the Egyptian military, and they were interesting, to say the least. But
how so?
Well, they're kind of a ragtag outfit. they were living in tents out in the middle of the desert, and they didn't seem too interested in getting back to Egypt. We were pushing them to get out, but they didn't have any real rush to go. So, in any case, I was never able to find anything weird about what they were shipping up. I looked at all their equipment and what they had staged to go back out. And Kuwait City port hadn't opened up. I brought the first ship into the port after the war. But when I left as a going away present, they had found an armadillo, believe it or not, out in the desert, and I guess they ate it. I don't know. They gave me the armadillo carcass, the shell, as a going away present. Now, what am I going to do with an armadillo? Unbelievable. But that was kind of interesting. The military intelligence guys were unorthodox the way they operated.
explain
it was,
that to
me. It was kind of neat to be able to go into Kuwait City and see how badly it was damaged from the Iraqi army. It was pretty sad. And our embassy was, of course, ransacked and beat up.
You said that the military intelligence guys were a little unorthodox. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, they kind of, they just sort of did what they wanted to do. If they had some kind of actionable intelligence that was going to impact our military, they would obviously try to root it out or know what was going on within the Kuwaiti infrastructure that might impact the military, because we still had a big presence north of Kuwait in a base up there. So they were always concerned about security threats, either real or not. But they went, you know, they moved about freely and went wherever they wanted and did whatever they wanted to do their mission. Kind of, I guess, call them spooks, I don't know. I just tagged along with them. I told them what I needed to have done and who I needed to talk to, and they set it up. I had to, I wanted to see all the vessel logs for the port of Kuwait City so that I could see what activity had gone on there right immediately before the war. And then when the Egyptians came in, they came through there and dumped their stuff off, and then their transports went home. And what got the Navy guys curious about it was they came over on 13 ships, but they needed 18 to go home. Couldn't figure out why they had to have that increase in capacity to get out, and that's what sparked their interest. But I was never able to determine, what there was anything wrong or not.
Yeah. So it wasn't that the U.S. or even the Kuwaitis were missing things. It was just that why this larger number of ships?
Correct.
Yeah.
And there was equipment all over Kuwait. Any road you took, you could see stuff that either was Allied equipment or was Iraqi equipment. And a lot of that stuff was valuable stuff. When that buildup took place over there, there was tremendous amount of equipment going in there that was of commercial manufacture that could be used commercially in Egypt, for instance. There were 4,000-gallon stainless steel tanker trailers over there by the hundreds that were shipped in there to carry potable water, for instance. And nobody knew who they belonged to, where they came from, or what. So, they were easy prey if somebody wanted to ride with them. You there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
So, that was kind of the crux of that little mission. But, our troops worked hard over there. They did a really good job, and we got everybody home safely.
How did you get involved in the Second Gulf War?
Well, I was an individual mobilization augmentee for Military Traffic Management Command headquarters. So, 2 days after 9/11, I got a call to report to Fort Eustis because they anticipated a requirement to move a whole lot of troops, and that's what happened. So I went up there and worked on a general staff for 5 years as G3 and G7.
Wow.
It was a really good tour.
Yeah.
It was an entirely different level from the company and battalion and brigade level.
Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, of course, it was
Fort Eustis was the G3 shop for Mitmick, which was headquartered in Alexandria. And Mitmick had all the transportation assets for ocean and air in the military side house, and some rail. But, you know, their responsibility was to do the logistics to move cargo and equipment. So when I got there, one of the big issues was ammunition security, which was within the United States, was moving, you know, ammunition moves across our highways every day, hazardous material, but it goes all over the country, and it had to be secured. There were fears that one of these trucks could be attacked or stolen or whatever, so that was ran through our shop. I didn't have that responsibility, but one of our other colonels had it, trying to track these shipments, make sure they were guarded properly, things of that nature. My responsibility was finding the manpower to run the ports here in the U.S. and in Kuwait, where we were going to run all our logistics. So as a reserve officer out of terminal unit, I understood all the units that were involved, and then I knew almost all the leadership in those units, so I knew who I could depend on to work different ports throughout the country. And so we ran ports from Oakland all the way around to Baltimore, deploying units when the buildup started. And that was, from what I was told, the largest logistics movement since World War II, deploying 13 divisions into the Gulf over a year's period, and then continuing to rotate and supply. But those were long, hard days, I'm telling you.
I'm sure.
You would start it. I would get in at about 5 o'clock because we had the ops center would have a briefing with the forces in Kuwait, so we tried to at least give them a little bit of a time where we would be available to do that without keeping them up through the middle of the night. So we would take care of that, and then we would have a video conference with our headquarters in Alexandria, which was where the two-star was. We had a one-star. And then we'd go about our business, and then 1500, we'd have another briefing for the one-star. And you'd work probably till 7 o'clock at night and come back and do it again the next day for about 5 years. Long, long tour, but good tour. We deployed a lot of equipment. The bad part about it was we had to put people on active duty for a year, and we messed up a lot of lives,
yeah,
a lot of families in doing that. But, you know, when you're in reserves, that's what you sign up for.
Right.
There's nothing that says you'll never be activated. So that was tough, and it got even harder when we started running out of people. And then we had to go into the individual mobilization assets, and those folks never thought they'd be on active duty, so digging them out was quite a chore too. And it was quite an adventure.
Well, let me take you back to Vietnam, just to a few last questions that I have for you. The United States and the communists settle, I guess, in 73 with the Paris Peace Accords. The American troops leave. What was your opinion of the way the United States left the war?
Well, I don't. Sometimes I think they let the South Vietnamese Army hold in the bag, but by the same token, it was just you sooner or later had to get out of there. Because I don't think the situation was going to change at all, ever. I don't believe that the South Vietnamese had the willingness to face them. I think that they were, the government was politically corrupt. That's personal opinion. And that filtered down into the military. I mean, they did not have the same goals and aims and desires that the North Vietnamese had. And so it was, to me, unlikely that they would have won. So I guess it was good to get out of there before we lost more people.
In April of 1975, Saigon falls, which is just the ultimate moment of what you just said. What was your opinion on the fall of Saigon and the loss of Vietnam?
I thought we were lucky to get out of there and get our embassy people out, number one. I think that a lot of South Vietnamese were unable to escape, suffered enormously, whether because of their political beliefs or they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure that was a terrible, terrible 10-year period when they were purging the government over there. You know, it's kind of sad that it came to that, that our expectations weren't met, nor were theirs. So it was a disappointment. The biggest disappointment was when I went to Washington and went to the Vietnam Memorial. And that's a stark reminder of the price we pay. But we continue to allow the politicians to influence the war fighters, and we can't do that in this country and be successful, and it's been proven. You know, we got disaster in Iraq. Afghanistan's no better. We just can't seem to get it right. Sadly.
Yeah.
And I'm not a war hawk by any means. I mean, I don't want my grandchildren to have to go fight another war. But, you know, our military has not had a lot of success in the last decade. So, I guess you kind of figure out whether you want to have a strong military or just be a milk toast.
What do you think you learned about yourself from your experiences in Vietnam? How did the war most affect you?
Well, I didn't. Number one, I didn't talk about it very much for many, many years. And number two, I knew I didn't want my kids to go in the military. Although I wanted to stay and serve. I didn't want them to have to fight in any war that wasn't going to have a good outcome. But, I learned a lot about people in that 3-year period of active duty, which helped me through the rest of my life. I think in the Citadel, they break you down and coach back up, and then you gotta learn how to take orders for you and give orders and all that kind of stuff. But when you're in the military, it's a little different in that these people aren't slaves, they're human beings. You have to treat them like human beings with respect and dignity and get them to work for you, and you do that with leadership, not with threats and turmoil.
Well,
know. I hope it's been worthwhile for us to do this. I feel like I was very fortunate to have the military career that I had, number one, to go to Vietnam and come back in one piece, number two. So my experience is probably a lot different from the people that really were in harm's way every day over there. And they have my everlasting respect, believe me. And I appreciate the opportunity to do this.
Well, it's been my pleasure.